One thing that's interesting in looking at how like gymnastics audiences versus layman audiences look at it is I think a lot of people who aren't intimately familiar with those Olympics think that we've done huge exaggerations in the commentator dialogue.
And you have not.
Yeah.
And welcome to Half In, Half Out, the only LGBTQ plus gymnastics podcast. I'm Kino, and today we are bringing you our interview with the creators of the Magnificent Seven musical, Julia Meinwald and Gordon Leary. They wrote the music and the book of the Magnificent Seven musical, respectively, and they took a lot of time out of their very busy schedules to chat with us about how this musical came to be. Just a heads up, if you aren't aware of what this musical is, it's about the gold-winning American WAG team at the 1996 Olympics in Atlanta, and that's the setting of the whole thing. And going into this interview, which we recorded about a month ago, I knew very little about the show other than the premise, and Blake knew a lot. And I think that really brings some interesting observations and questions during our chat that you'll really enjoy. But yeah, we got to talk with Julia and Gordon, and I think that they answer a lot of our questions that we really have, like, how do you create a musical about gymnastics? And what does that look like on stage? And what's that creative process look like? But the Magnificent Seven musical is going to premiere July 7th in Theater One at Theater Row in New York. Tickets are currently on sale if you are able to get to New York to go see it, and we'll link to the show's website below where you can buy tickets. If you want to support the show but you can't go because you can't get out to New York or whatever reason, you can always donate, and we have a link to their donation site as well. You can also listen to the awesome music from this show on their website. I'm personally very partial to 36 Hours in Atlanta, and I think you'll know why once you listen to it. If you want more reasons to talk about the way Tim Daggett is, I think that's a song that you need to listen to. But we had a really great time chatting with Julia and Gordon, and we really hope you enjoyed this interview. We have some more interviews in the wings that hopefully you'll see soon. But for now, here's Julia and Gordon.
Hello, Julia and Gordon. How are you?
Hello. Doing well.
Yes, indeed.
So glad to hear it, especially because I imagine it's probably a busy time for you all.
Yes, a little bit of a special time.
It is. Things are ramping up, certainly.
Oh, yes. Okay, so we are here to talk about Magnificent Seven, the musical. And could you just tell our listeners who is who and what your role has been in the production?
I'm Julia. I write the music.
And I'm Gordon. I write the book and lyrics. And with this production, we are also co-producing together The Run. So it's a self-made project this summer.
Probably not a good thing that I keep forgetting to even mention that.
you'll get there. But by the time this comes out, you'll be like press pros. You'll have it all down. So for folks who don't already know, can you tell people a little bit about like your writing partnership and the stuff that you've done together in the past?
Yeah, we can tag team this, I guess. Great. So we met at NYU's Graduate Musical Theater Writing Program, and we've been writing together for, I think, a little over 13 years.
Wow.
I forget which anniversary we just had.
13 or 14.
Yeah, it might be 14.
Sometime in March. March is our anniversary. We've lost count.
Although for 20, we should do some huge concerts.
Yes.
The first tier, do you want to do our first show and then we can go back and forth?
I want to talk
about all the shows.
Yeah. So we started writing together on a project that was called Pregnancy Pact, inspired by the, you know, what we now know as an apocryphal story of a group of high school girls who all got pregnant together. The principal blamed them, saying that it was this pact that they made. And of course, that was proven not to be real. It was all to cover up problems with distributing condoms and pregnancy tests that in the school, but the idea of a pregnancy pact mm-hmm. kind of took root in American culture, and so we thought what would make that kind of thing believable to people, and use that as a jumping off point to really tell a story about teenage girls who were like searching for a family and searching for just kind of the love and belonging that they weren't finding elsewhere.
Yeah.
And Yeah, so that started us off on our journey of writing about groups of young women.
And we followed that up with a show called The Loneliest Girl in the World, which is about anti-gay rights activist Anita Bryant and the gay rights activist who pies her in the face.
Yes.
Yes.
That's awesome.
Which was another sort of interesting one. It's a dual protagonist between the gay rights activist and between Anita Bryant.
Yeah.
And, you know, sort of walking that line of wanting to humanize Anita Bryant and again sort of answer this question of why would someone make these decisions and act this way?
Right.
So sort of being able to empathize with her without, you know, giving credence to or sort of condoning any of those views.
Yeah.
That's awesome. And I think that's something that comes up a lot in what we write is this idea of, you know, when we say, oh, we're writing a musical about a pregnancy pact, or, oh, we're writing a musical about a gymnastics team, people kind of make assumptions about what that will be just based on their experience with the form of musical theater or anything like that. And so, you know, assume that we're writing something as a spoof or something like that. And we really, we take our musical theater seriously. Really want it, because to us there's something that's like so human about singing and so like deeply emotional that we, you know, use the form to explore these things that, you know, don't otherwise make sense to us, and find that humanity.
I made a comment to someone today. I was like, yeah, I'm talking to the people who are creating the Mag 7 musical. And they're like, excuse me, there's a Magnificent, there's a Magnificent 7 musical. And I was like, yes. And I cannot explain it to you.
Because we'll be able to in a couple hours.
We will be able to. But I'm like, I don't think maybe, I'm like, I don't know. I go, it's a gymnastics thing. I go, we care because gymnastics and musicals, and we love both of those things. I guess, so now our job is to, you know.
Yes. And I
tell everybody else why they should care.
Yes. And I should say, before we get back to the saga of shows, two things. One is this, like, complexity of the experiences thing is a theme that I'm noticing, and that, so I took the opposite approach to Kino. So Kino is coming at this interview from a person who has absolutely no context for this show.
Yeah.
And I took the approach of, I consumed almost everything there is to consume.
Oh, wow.
That exists on the internet. You're so welcome. I'm sure I got some looks in the car today.
I've been avoiding it, but it probably, for the purposes of this interview, is best that you're we're coming at from completely opposite approaches. I've just been very busy, okay?
And so I will bring this up later when we talk about this show, but that totally makes sense to me that this is a thing that is a theme in your writing of, like, these are really complex people and situations, and let's try to find ways to explore this more complexly, which I just, like, is very in line with my general worldview, which I appreciate.
Wonderful.
We did that show, and then where do we go from there?
So then, oh, sorry.
I was going to say, you can take your pick, because then we started writing a bunch of things at the same time, so.
Right. So one of the things that we started writing, so we kind of were writing two things at the same time that were alongside Magnificent Seven. We've been writing this show called Reb and Vodka and Me, which, if we want to talk about complex and dark, is probably as far as we can go, which is about the online community of the Tumblr community of Columbiners, which are which is, they're organized around people who have an interest in the Columbine High School shooters. We wouldn't necessarily call them fans. I think some people call them fans. Yeah. We, you know, want to go deeper than that. But it was, again, much like Pregnancy Pact, it was something we read an article about, and we were just kind of flabbergasted that this was something that people engaged in and wanted to get to the root of it. And so, you know, that obviously was a very dark world to explore in research. You know, the actual world of is much more, you know, has many more layers and shades than just, like, sad, angry people. But obviously anything dealing with school shootings takes a lot. And so while we were working on that, we decided to, like, match our late 90s nostalgia with with Magnificent Seven, which actually coincidentally was the first musical that Julia and I ever talked about writing. When we were in grad school together, we didn't write together that much when we were in school. But, you know, we were talking about what we might write, and it was the thing that I've always wanted to write since I was 17, you know, a few years after that Olympics. And yeah, so it's been on the back burner or in our minds for a very long time.
Oh, that's really, that is,
Is fascinating to me. And in not in a negative way. I say things are fascinating all the time and oftentimes in a negative way, but that's really interesting to me that this musical is not like a, I don't think you could have somebody write this musical and not have a long interest in gymnastics by any means. But like the fact that it's been in your mind since you were 17 years old, I think that is very interesting.
It was before I realized that I wasn't much of a composer. And so I like wrote a song and a half that were terrible that I don't think I've ever like sung for Julia.
Yeah, I've anything. Never heard these early.
There's no need to hear them. There's no need for anyone to hear them. But it is, it like automatically from seeing it, I understood how it sang and how it, you right. know, kind of tracked that the dramatic arc was so built in both just by circumstance and by NBC, you know, so.
Well, right. And I would just like to say that I opened up your website and I realized that Tim Daggett is a character in this musical. So that's why I was sitting here for a moment. There. So I was, when I was sitting here, just like, that's because it was me realizing that, that good old Timmy.
That also makes that choice and everything about that character make so much more sense. If you just like yes. have been in Tim Daggett's world. Because I was like, how did you get in Tim Daggett's head? And I'm like, oh, because you've been in Tim Daggett's head since you were 17. I understand.
Right. Oh, we've all, my goodness.
We've all been there. Mm-hmm. At least, like these three of like it, we can relate.
Yeah. I'm just obsessed with this concept of Tim Daggett being here. So,
are there any other projects that we didn't get to in that?
Nothing else that we probably need to talk about. There's a few other irons in the fire, but those are big tent poles.
That's good, though. I'm glad that there's like many things happening yes. and that we're doing less of that.
You know, you said that you came to this idea when you were 17, but I guess what brought you to the Magnificent Seven story? And I'm going to tack on to the end of the question, like in the form of a musical, why were you like, yes, this should be a musical?
To answer the second part first, I guess.
Yeah.
And this maybe sounds like a cop-out, but I think Gordon, I've heard you say this now, and I'm just going to paraphrase it instead of just letting you say it, but that since writing musicals is sort of the way that we tell stories, mm-hmm. anything sort of comes through the lens of this is the way that we sort of know how to express things and generate ideas. Mm-hmm. And like Gordon was saying before, the idea of it, you know, it really does sing. It has this sort of built-in larger-than-life stakes mm-hmm. to it.
The stakes are high. The emotions are high. There's like great joy, great loss, great mm-hmm. longing, all of those things that to us sing so well.
Right. And I guess another thing is that a lot of the musical is we're trying to get inside the girls' heads. And I think that the idea of right. like going into a song and it's like, okay, here's where we've chiseled in and tried to guess where they're at emotionally.
Right.
You know, as opposed to a play where they would never just say these things as dialogue.
Right. Like you couldn't, I think that's a very fair point. You could not do this as a play. This could not just be a straight play. Like,
no,
doesn't work that way.
No, and that makes a ton of sense too. Having like heard all of the music show, I was in the car, so I wasn't looking at, I couldn't see at all times who had each song, but essentially, like most, if not all of the main characters have at some point a solo or like a look into their head and where they're at various points throughout the story, which is really cool.
Yeah, that's been an interesting thing dramaturgically because, yeah. you know, when you're like writing a show and if you have one main character, you want to make sure they have like a nice arc from beginning to end. But when you have seven main characters, mm-hmm. it's sort of a lot to track to make sure that everyone does have some sort of arc, some sense of resolution.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, and I think that's part of, you know, if it wasn't necessarily initially it was more of the like sparkle of the event, I think one of the things that brought us to that story is, again, we are interested in a lot of ways in telling stories about communities of women. And just, you know, we don't really write like boy meets girl stories. Maybe we will one day, but that's not our where our interests lie.
Right.
And I think that also, as you heard, Julia writes some killer 7-part harmony. So that's also really fun. to imagine things that Julia can write amazing complex vocals for.
Yes. And I have in here specific questions about like specific songs. And this is probably the time to tell you that I was like a giant choir nerd. And I am a trans person, so this also will not surprise you. I was an alto 2 who genuinely begged the choir director before I knew I was trans to be a tenor 1. And now I am like a literal bass 2, and it's my favorite thing in the world.
I love that for you.
But because I went from like alto 2 who wanted to be a tenor 1, tenor 2 to real bass, I love harmony. I didn't quite get as much of the gene. My brother has the like perfect pitch, like can learn an instrument in 2 days kind of savant thing going on. I got like, I can pick this up a little bit quicker than some of my peers, but that's really where my love was, the harmony. So that is absolutely one of my favorite things about
I'm a soprano, so melody or bust. Let me tell you that.
Who is she? I've never met her. I don't know her.
I actually, not to like go off track, but I was doing an alumni choir rehearsal for my high school, and they were like, we're going to split you into first and second sopranos. I go, I will not be singing second sopranos because I haven't sang in 10 years and I cannot sing anything other than melody. Like, that's not happening.
But yes, that also makes a lot of sense in terms of the stuff that we're going to talk about next in terms of the story and the music and the conflict that exists in those harmonies used really effectively, which I appreciate. So before I get into all of my like nerdy, very specific questions about this musical, to the extent that you want to share with an audience who we want to go see this, tell us a bit about kind of where we start off, the timeline that we're looking at in this musical, what you chose to focus on, all of that.
Yeah, so the show, it's in our own nerdy way, we are hoping it will run 96 minutes just for because yes, we want everything to be 96. It's 96 pages in the script and all these things. But in that 90-ish minutes, we follow the 2 days of team competition so July 21st and July 23rd, with a little break in between. And so really it tracks those events pretty specifically. You get, you know, Shannon gets the chalk in her eye, JC falls, all of those things that really happened. And you know, they travel through in, you know, the order bars being floor vault in the order that they did it and everything. So it's contained that way. But within that, as Julia said, it's so much about when they would be doing their routine or program or whatever. We take those moments to give them something to sing about mostly.
Do you have anything that you want to add to that in the story? That was great. That's perfect. You're like, that's his thing. yeah, you mentioned the J.C. Phelps falling piece, which is when I was listening through the first time, was one of the things that really stuck out to me, not really knowing how long you'd been connecting to this story. But I'm curious both like in terms of setting that song up as well as musically, what was it like to kind of get into her head as like the girl who fell? So it's a very I'm trying to think of the best words to describe this art. Like, I don't think the best words to describe this. Gymnastics I think this is one of the many moments where it's like, oh, gymnastics people get this, and you captured that really well.
That's great.
I mean, musically it's hard. It's always hard when you're writing real people, and you know, I don't necessarily think that, you know, if JC sang in real life, these would be the notes she sings or the harmonies she uses. So I feel like you're always just trying to tap into what the emotion of that moment feels like to you. Yeah. This is sort of a tangent, but in that show we were talking about before, Pregnancy Pact, there's this one song where one of the girls, the first one to get pregnant, sings about what it feels like. And I remember the very first time that Gordon and I brought that song into a lab, the sort of moderator of the lab was like, "Oh, it's really funny how you've chosen to make the music sound like so anxious." And I was like, "Oh no, that was my version of happy. That's like what my happy music sounds like."
Yeah.
Like, you never really know.
Yeah. Oh, that's funny.
And I think that the girl who fell moment specifically, it actually is the, it replaced another song that we had written for JC that felt less specific and felt less, well, less emotionally grounded. And when we were looking at things to musicalize, I mean, there's obviously, I think one of the things that we found with the show is that so much of it is specific to gymnastics, but translates to any pursuit. I think so much of it translates to into theater and performing, especially with, you know, the actors that were, well, we'll probably talk about this later, but the actors who are doing the show are mostly in their 30s-ish. We think the show resonates a lot with us elder millennials, who were, you know, adolescents at the time of that gymnastics or that Olympics. And so I think there's a lot of talk about the expectations you put on yourself, the expectations others put on you, how you can measure your own success, how you can, you know, what it, just the anxieties of feeling like there's only one way to do something, and if you fall off that path, are you ruined forever? I mean, I think that's like a really universal thing. So I think I love that you feel like it resonates as coming at it from a gymnastics point of view, because I do think that there is something so universal about so much of this, but that moment in particular.
I've got to shamelessly plug Gordon, since you mentioned it. If anyone feels like donating to our fundraising campaign, one of the donation gifts that you get is the recording of JC's cut song.
Ooh. That has sold it very effectively to me at the very least. It's one of those things where after I saw that, like, that was kind of like the track list, I like thought to myself, like, I can't imagine a JC Phelps like focus moment being called anything else. Like, it is such a perfect, I just think it's a really great choice in terms of like how to build her as a person. And the piece, I think, just really to gymnastics, so that gymnastics people are just going to get, is whether we're fans or gymnasts, we've either experienced that thing of like, I have now let everyone down, even non-gymnastics people, to your point of like universality, that feeling of like, I am going to let everybody down, or I have let everybody down, or I've worked so hard for this thing, and then this is really what happens here. We're particularly close with certain gymnasts who have had essentially this story, mm-hmm. right? And I think as somebody who considers myself like an actual friend to people who have had this level of story, like on the Olympic trials stage, mm-hmm. etc. mm-hmm. That for me at Red is like, oh, this is really cool to see this. The thing that feels very specific being seen and being represented in this way that is so universal and great. I have one other song in the show that I want to ask about, which is My Body Is, because I think that might get a little deep. Is there any other songs or other parts of the musical specifically that you want to let our audience know about? Any like favorite pieces you want to mention, or anything else before we get to My Body Is conversation?
I almost want to give a shout out to a moment that is almost definitely going to be cut, just so people know that it did exist, which is the like 10-minute mini opera for Tesh and Tim Daggett and Elfie Schlegel between the days of competition, which Yeah, we had for a while. It's called 36 Hours in Atlanta. And it just imagines, it's sort of the biggest departure from reality in the show.
I need that in my life, though.
A recording exists.
Yeah, it exists. I listened to it today on the way home. It very much is real.
Okay, good. Because I think if you told me that I had no way of ever hearing that in my entire life, I think I would have to, like, I don't know.
No, it already exists. And also, that makes sense of a thing that would have to get cut. But also, like, I love that you wrote that.
I think the spirit of that moment will remain in a different form. But, you know, there are some crazy practicalities involved in putting a show up that, you know, a 10-minute going into a whole other world maybe isn't. This is not the time to explore that moment.
Yeah. As much as the universe deserves to see all of what happens in that.
See, this is what I'm going to have to do is immediately go then listen to everything.
Exactly. That's what I'm trying to do. See.
Oh, I mean, I am like, yeah, no, I'm 100% on board.
Yeah.
I'm really excited. And
we do feel like the what we learned from the 10-minute fever dream was that, you know, there is being able to have Elfie Schlegel in the show, especially to kind of look at what happens after you age out or are injured and can no longer compete, or your Olympics, the year you're supposed to go to the Olympics, you can't. You know, having that future to look forward to, and then there's a magical moment later in the show that where another visitor from outside the team comes. Yeah. Just exploring beyond those seven athletes, what like the cycles of the sport are, and how, you know, what it means to be a woman, especially with Elfie, like what it means to kind of join the other side and talk about the athletes the way that they get talked about and all that stuff. And then, of course, she got replaced by a younger person.
Yeah,
eventually too. I think we're still excited about exploring Elfie.
Yeah. She's like, Tim is still here.
Tim is. Yes, he is.
Yeah, that's I literally was listening to that on the way home, and I got to that part where they're talking about, like, no, it's literally only gymnastics. Yeah. And I was like, oh, like, that's another one of those things that, like, as people who interview gymnasts all the time, it is often actually legitimately hard to, we're trying to have conversations with them mostly about the not gymnastic stuff. And some gymnasts just have a really hard time getting there.
Yeah.
And the other thing that we see a lot is, much like other people who experience this for other reasons, myself included, they get to college and start figuring out that they're queer, because it's the first time that they're in the gym 20 hours a week instead of 40, 50, 60. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden there's capacity to and time to explore and start thinking about things.
I mean, we've had conversations with gymnasts where they're like, I literally had to like sit down and think about, am I a straight person? And for some of those people, the conclusion was, yes, I am a straight person. But they're like, I've never literally.
But they realize as adults, they never thought about it.
They're like, I've never actually thought about it because my life has been so focused singularly, like, on sport. But also, I mean, I'm also, now that you say that, like, it's just when, you know, the idea that it's just gymnastics, it's another way of just being like, well, it's another way that people constantly belittle gymnastics.
Yeah.
Like, I was having a conversation with someone and I was planning very, very far ahead for something. I was like, oh, I'm not available. I know I'm not available. I can tell you that I'm not available 9 months ahead of time. And they're like, is there gymnastics? I was like, actually, no. I know that you think it's a little silly that this is something that's like a very big part of my life.
Yeah.
But it's not just gymnastics, but also no.
Yeah, and that conflict is totally there as it like currently exists, which is a thing that people can listen to regardless of what piece ends up in the show. But is like that conflict totally exists with like a third party, to where it's like, I do not believe you all that this is this important to you or that it was for this amount of time. and then only gymnastics. Like, I think that's another moment where I'm like, gymnastics people, I think, get that more than non-gymnastics people who are there, or who listen to it, where it's just like, no, literally, that's not, they're not actually exaggerating. Mm. This is a problem for grown people.
Yes.
Who grew up in the sport that they...
Like, and, removing and, yourself from something that is just...
Yeah, or never thinking about what their career was going to be, or not, or having, especially in the past, to choose to not do college gymnastics, and so they just, like, didn't go to college. Mm.
Or, like, the idea that you know that you're in a sport that, unfortunately, and we are fortunately moving away from, like, gymnastics having such a strict, in so many senses, timeline, but, like, you've, a lot of gymnasts have existed in a timeline where I will be done probably by this age. Mm-hmm. You know, we have the outliers, we have Chuso, and we have so many other, especially outside of the U.S., gymnasts who are, you know, they're in their 30s and they're competing.
Yeah.
But, you know, in the U.S., you're, and I do really mean, like, fortunately that we are moving away from this, but, like, you've lived your whole life thinking, okay, this is when my window for the Olympics is, this is my window for college, and then around 22, 23-ish, my gymnastics career is done, and I haven't thought past that point yet.
That is the perfect segue. Do you want to talk about how that is addressed in the show? Because it absolutely is.
Yeah, we actually, this idea of a ticking clock is in so many things. There's a song that's sung by the three gymnasts who are 19 at the game. So Shannon Miller, mm-hmm. and Dominique Dawes and Amanda Borden, that is about what it feels like to, like, be, it's called Prime. And one of the lyrics is, now I'm of course forgetting the lyrics that I wrote. I'm in my prime. Leah, can you help me? Why am I?
Which chorus are you going
to? There are so many. But just this idea that, like, I'm in my prime, and because I am in my prime right now, that means that immediately after, there's no slow, like, drive off into the sunset. It's like a cliff that, yeah. I am the best I will ever be right now, and knowing that there's nothing, there is no next step. Yeah.
For, like, lack of a better phrase, like, gymnastics in a lot of ways is like Thelma and Louising it. It's just, mm-hmm. I just came up with that right now, but I, like, I feel that way. Like, you know, for a lot of people, it's just Olympics done.
Yeah.
This song, I feel like that we have sort of, like, is in conversation with that is the song Four More Years,
yep.
where they mm-hmm. sort of are contending with, oh, if I actually do get to come back to the Olympics, that's four more years of, like, this
yes.
of pressure.
Right, because, you know, Amy Chow, and I am blanking. There was someone else who also was in Sydney.
Dominique Dawes.
Okay, that was... I was pretty sure it was Dominique. Yep. But I was like, I know Amy Chow. Gosh, I'm a bad fan. It's been a long day. But no, like, yeah, that idea that it's not that you don't want to go to another Olympics. It's that you have to physically put yourself through four more years. Like, you know, when, like, not to veer off track again, but, like, Simone coming back after a year.
I thought about that a lot.
You know, was a pretty big deal because she talked about, like, I started to get skills back a lot faster than I thought I would. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's a lot of reasons for that and not just, well, she's Simone. But it is another, like, it's also, like, think about the Olympic cycle we just had. It was a 5-year cycle. Mm-hmm. Like, it was a 5-year quad, right? And, you know, we can get into whatever, but it truly affected so many people. Like,
yeah. If it had been a year earlier, our friend would have been there, and that makes
Morgan Hurd would have been on that. Sorry, I'm going to go there. That Morgan Hurd would have been on that gymnast, on that team. And, you know, that's neither here nor there, but it really does. Like, 4 years is, you, like, the pacing. And you know this as gymnastic, you know, a gymnastic fan. Like, but it is just, it's not just, are you going to come back? Like, you know, everybody talks about, is Simone going to come back for 2024? Well, guess what? Now we're in a 3-year Olympic cycle. You know, like, the 5-year cycle affects the 3-year cycle, and it's, yeah. or another 4-year cycle. And it's like, it's not a quad, it's a triad, yeah. and it's a nightmare.
Yeah. yeah. And I think y'all do a really good job of exploring kind of, like, every, the point about complexity in all of your work, like, each, and this is actually true for a lot of the songs throughout, that the lyrics are kind of like listing each thing. Like it's going to be this for my elbows, and it's going to be this for my knees, and it's going to be this for my time, and it's going to be this for my education, and what, like, walking through, I think this show's gonna be really interesting for gymnastics people. And I think moments that might read as purely, like, maybe not purely, but as more determination, grit, how strong these people are to non-gymnastics people, I think two gymnastics people are going to read as very, like, tragic. And we've seen this. And, like, my first hearing of 4 years, not realizing who was singing it, I was like, this is really sad. Because they're probably not, like, realistically, any, like, and literally in the case of this show, like, anyone else singing that song, it wouldn't be true.
Right.
But in their case, it is. But my first, like, hearing that song was like, oh, but they're not. And to explore it from that, it'll be interesting because a lot of gymnastics people there will know that those two in particular do.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But
I mean, so many of the other team members tried for 2000.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a little epilogue where we talk about some of that. So, you know, any of them, or five of the seven of them, could have been singing that song, and it would have taken on a very different meaning.
Yeah.
Well, I even think about, like, that song, if you take that song into the context, and I haven't listened to it, so I have no idea, let's be perfectly honest, but just the idea of 4 more years is also even more daunting now. When you have these teams that are shrinking in size, taking Gabby and Allie, and then you also take, you know, Simone from Rio to Tokyo, and, like, Lori made that attempt, or, like, you know, Nastia and Sean and all of those people all attempted, and you only really have a couple cases. I mean, and we're not going to get into the discourse around Gabby Douglas, okay? Right. Because, like, that's unfair to Gabby Douglas. But, you know, then there's discourse about whether this person should be there. And it's just like, oh, my God.
It's like a very no-win situation that I feel like is addressed as such in a way that is helpful.
Yeah, it's a no-win, and yeah.
The thing that gets me is, like, none of them can help the year that they were born in, which is, like, at the root of it, that seems to be the number one thing. Like, if you are you know, in 96, at least, if you were lucky enough to be 14, then you knew that you could come back one more time. But if you're JC and you were 16, it wasn't as
right. Guaranteed. Or, like, thinking about, like, all the people, you know, from 19 who didn't go to the 1980 Olympics, like, how many people on the MAG and the WAG side, like, they never got there. You know, some people did manage to make that jump, like, but a lot of people didn't because, you know, the window is so small. My feelings about it a little bit.
Yeah, but that was a nice thing to have explored too. The other song that I want to spend some time on is My Body Is, and I think that's a really great representation of a few things. How I think that's going to feel very universal for, like, in a lot of ways, for just, like, all women and people assigned female at birth, maybe especially, like, right now, like, it's, and I think it reads as very, for me, in addition to when I hear the song, but even just seeing the title of that in a track list, I'm going, okay, this is a larger conversation about gymnastics and what we now know about this team and what we now know about teams that came afterwards and conversations that have had to happen since in gymnastics in a lot of ways. Is there a place that you want to start off with talking about this song, or do you want me to start off with questions?
I think context of it, when we set out to write it, I think one of the ideas from the get-go that we wanted to explore was this idea of national pride being placed on teenage girls' bodies, very literally in the red, white, and blue leotard, but just, like, this idea that they're imbued with so much by, you know, the viewers, by the Olympic Committee, by everyone, and become a stand-in for America. And there is such fragility in there, both physically and emotionally, that, you know, it's just, I mean, the only word we can I can think of as icky, which is, you know, not the smartest sounding word, but the appropriate word. Yeah. I think we approached the song with that in mind. And I think as it became also about injury and about all of those things, we wrote it in 2016.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's one of the first songs we wrote for the show.
It has kind of spanned shift in discussion, or not the shift in discussion, but like new focus on that idea with everything that happened at the last Olympics.
Like, it's a very moan body autonomy story. Mm-hmm. It's also a, like, the lyric, there's that, like, my body is not mine. Mm-hmm. And that is, I think, one of the most profound lyrics you can put into a gymnastics musical. Mm-hmm. For coaching abuse of all types reasons, for this pressure that you're talking about of, like, the pressure of falling, to the pressure of, like, not getting injured, to the pressure of, like, my body has to look and be a certain way, is explored a ton throughout the show. Like, this is my, it's another example of, like, kind of listing off all of the many ways. Like, this is my profession. This is my livelihood. This is my future. This is for my country. This is for my family. And circling back several times to people being to a place of it being for themselves, that the reality of all of those pressures being put on people who are so young, and especially who are women, and it being so tied to their body. And musically, it's very haunting, which I appreciate. How did you decide? So as the song kind of goes, there's kind of like injury stories that are spread in throughout. How did you make those decisions about what you were going to include in that song?
Well, I did kind of go through injury histories for all of them. And I think we didn't want, you know, there are some that are, all of them are gruesome, but obviously we didn't want to just like go for shock value. So a lot of it was the three that we touch on are Monique Dawes with the wrist injury, Amy Chow's fall at trials, and Shannon Miller with an elbow injury that required surgery. And I think it was, a lot of them had to do with the way that they interacted with coaches, thinking about it in the long term, how the like decision that's made for to get to the Olympics or to get to the next meet is actually going to carry with them for the rest of their life. And, you know, and some of it, we already knew that we're going to explore Carrie's injury later in the show. So we, you know, didn't include some of the horrifying things that she's talked about. And
one of my favorites of the ones that Gordon chose to include is the Amy Chow one, because the way that Gordon structured it is she delivers it sort of like a hero story. Like the last line of that monologue is like, and I still qualified by almost 0.8 of a point. And I always, that's sort of the triumph of still qualifying on the tail of this horrific beam injury always is really striking to me.
Right. When she says, I checked to make sure my eye was still there, which, you know, I am putting words in her mouth. So right now we're talking about Amy Chow as character, it's, they're just gruesome. And I think especially to audiences who have a much more fleeting relationship with gymnastics, I think those stories, I think one that people gasp at the most is the Shannon Miller dislocating, I'm forgetting.
It's like a bone, piece of her bone comes off.
In her elbow. Yeah. And that, you know, she had pins put in, but didn't cast because she needed to be back on the bar sooner than a cast would allow.
Yeah.
Just, you know, is mind-blowing. Yeah. I think to, especially to a non, an audience that's less familiar with it.
Yeah. And the part that's actually with the Amy Chow situation was when she's like, I wasn't dizzy, at least, like, I don't think I was, like, I don't think so. Mm-hmm. Especially as a coach, like, I was just like, this, that to me felt like a great gymnastics nod to like we were not, literally not checking people for concussions, and she fully is, but that is, to me, that is, like, going, like, yeah, I need to stop and get a concussion check, and I didn't, and this could have been, like, deadly.
How much should we talk about concussion protocol now? Like,
yeah. That's, like, one of the few things I was required to be trained on before I was allowed to be a coach.
I mean, even, like, as somebody who works in education, like, literally, like, you know, something happens, like, a kid, like, falls or something, I'm like, my first question is, did you hit your head?
Yeah.
Like, like, sip in their chairs all the time. And I'm like, four on the floor, you know? But I'm like, I have a kid who has tipped out of his chair multiple times. And I'm like, every time I'm like, did you hit your head? And they're like, do you care? I'm like, I honestly mostly care that he didn't hit his head. Because that is, like, a whole other, like, I gotta go document stuff. Yeah. Like, also, concussion. Like, head injuries are bad. I'm preaching to the choir.
We haven't touched on our... who listen to us are mostly gymnastics people. So I have some questions about the fact that we've made a gymnastics musical. And how does that, and how does that work? Like, I think,
what does that look like?
That's on people's minds. So yeah,
conceptually.
So,
great question.
Yeah, so these, so, I mean, we've seen some other shows too, so I kind of, I also kind of know the answer, but we're casting gymnasts. So how do we have a gymnastics musical, have gymnastics, and make all of that work?
That is the big question, and has always been the big question of the show. That this is our, the first time that we're able to get it up on its feet. So we've had lots of discussions about what can be used to represent gymnastics. From the beginning, we've referred to it as a gymnastics musical in which no gymnastics is done. And, you know, especially in this instance where our stage is, what is it, like 10 by 20 maybe at most, you know, no gymnastics could be done. But I think that goes a lot to the question of universality, that this is about emotional moments and about taking another look at a story we thought we knew. And I'm sure there will be nods to things. I mean, I don't think we can do a song in which Dominique Moceanu is performing her floor routine without the, like, famous little twist and wink thing that she did. Yeah. In Devil,
I'm literally, like, imagining shadow puppets gymnastics.
That has, yeah, no,
we've talked about it all. We've talked about puppets. We've talked about film.
I'm like, there's a silhouette of gymnastics happening in the background. Like,
we don't want to do. We don't want to just, like, one style of dance that's meant to be like gymnastics, because so almost all of the songs are in the place where people would otherwise be doing gymnastics. So I think we want to, that's part of the fun of the theatricality and the fun of it is exploring, get the spirit of it and kind of the, how impressive it is and how cultured it, all of those things without having people actually performing skills.
Yeah.
We sometimes joke, like, in our musical, it's, you know, it's vocal gymnastics, which is, you know, sort of tongue-in-cheek. But I think it is also true in a way that when you have, like, a lady belting a high F, I mean, which is not something we do that often, but that some of the physical difficulty of the singing hopefully does channel some of that same spirit.
That's brilliant.
That's brilliant.
That's one of those answers where I'm just like, my brother, who does not care at all about musical theater, but as a music nerd, will be like, that's the coolest, that's cool, your podcast did a cool thing. Yeah, and that all really comes for me, even without, like, I had like workshop visual, like I could see their track jackets, whatever, but not like the visuals that are gonna be actual visuals. So excited about that comes through. I highlighted a question.
Yeah. So we've talked about, you know, the different emotions running through the show from the gymnasts. And we talk a little bit about these other characters that we have over here. Our lovely, lovely is a loose word for some of them. commentators. Yeah. Can you talk about how commentary is used in the show? Like, people who listen to this podcast will be very interested in this answer. We love to talk about commentary and everything that makes us angry about it. So yeah.
One thing that's interesting in looking at how like gymnastics audiences versus layman audiences look at it is I think a lot of people who aren't intimately familiar with those Olympics think that we've done huge exaggerations in the commentator dialogue.
And you have not.
Yeah. I can't wait. I'm so excited.
About 80%, I would say, of the commentator dialogue is
verbatim.
You know, what we would refer to as found text. You know, little girls dancing for gold.
Yep.
In there, you know, some of the, my favorite is somebody on the bars and Elfie Schlegel just says, ugh, cautious, cautious, cautious.
Handstands, it's all about handstands.
Yes.
There's a lot of those, and I put this question in here because a bunch of those come from Tim Daggett.
Yes.
Which is absolutely, and also making fun, there is making fun of Tim Daggett that happens in the show.
I need Tim Daggett to see this musical.
He is certainly an archetype. I think he has some parallel characters in other sports commentating. I think he and is it Scott Hamilton, the ice skate? Is that his name? Scott?
There is a person named Scott Hamilton who does ice skating. I have no idea in what relation.
I think that's his name. But, you know, the kind of the, like very overeager,
right.
Wants to please everybody, still so excited about it, even though even as his like distance between his competitive life and the rest of his life grows wider.
Honestly, with Tim Daggett, that's what is just so like insane, for lack of a better phrase, to me. Because like Tim Daggett is not, you know, not Terry Gannon coming in and being like, I commentate all sports, NBC just put me here, or, you know, whatever. It's like, no, Tim, you competed. Think about all the things that were probably said about you that probably made you very upset, and you're now saying those things. Yeah. And yes. I'm like, do you not? I don't think, and I will say, I don't think Tim Daggett ever goes out of his way to like and
be ignorant.
Okay.
Yeah.
Or ignorant cool. or anything like that.
Yeah.
But sometimes I'm like, Tim, honey, think about what is coming out of your mouth.
Yeah.
Like, because I just like, and that's, I have gotten very, I've talked about things that Tim has said on the show a lot. And every time I'm just like, you're not Al Trotwig. You're like, we all hate and we're like, goodbye, Al Trotwig. But like, we have higher expectations for you because you were in this sport. Yeah. And I do expect you to have some sort of self-awareness that I do not think Tim Daggett has. So
yeah,
I'm looking forward to this.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you explored that complexity too of like, you are now the person who's saying these things about people.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Have you any interactions with any of the people that are portrayed in this musical?
I have not. We have, at least through the writing process, purposely been avoiding it. I think, you know, for us, it everything in the show is written out of like a deep love and admiration and affection for them. Mm-hmm. So I don't think, hope that none of them would be offended by anything or think that we got anything wrong or anything like that. But we also don't want to color anything.
Right.
You know, especially if like we became Twitter friends with one of them, you know, we don't want to like imbalance within the storytelling and things like that. We did just recently, I've been one of our fundraisers is I'm also an illustrator outside of this, so I've been doing these shirts of them, and Dominique Mociano did enjoy my drawing of her doing Devil Went Down to Georgia.
Yes.
But that's the first action we've had.
And to kind of build off of that, like from a writing perspective, as someone who does some writing, do you think that just it's one of those things like they're people, but they are also characters? Like you have to separate that in some sort of way, because blurring the line then kind of you when you're like, this is a, it's kind of actually, okay, I'm gonna make another comparison. Like when I went and saw Spencer with Kristen Stewart as Princess Diana, excellent film. The beginning of the film, have either of you seen it?
Nah,
okay. No. It says this is a fable on tragic events or something like that. It's the idea that like we're telling you a story about something that we really don't have that much information about because we were not there. It's not heavily documented. And in this case, Diana is a character. And I guess I kind of see that same thing here. Like if you start hanging out with Carrie Strug on Twitter, like that is going to anyways deeply complicate things and the approach to the creative process, especially like when you think about the dynamics of even just like media surrounding The Magnificent Seven, like, and we haven't really talked about Carrie and the vault or anything like that, but like the idea that like Carrie Strug went on her own tour after the Olympics. She was like, I'm not doing this Olympic tour on the Carrie Strug, like the Carrie Strug train. Like, I don't know. I think that really respect the fact that like you have made an attempt to just like, I mean, attempt or just the conscious decision, like to separate. Like they are real people, but like at the same time, for the purposes of this musical, I can interact with you. I can only interact with the public perception of you and try to figure out what's in your mind. I don't know. I find that interesting from a creative perspective.
Go ahead, Julia.
I was just going to say, I think, you know, if you tried to make it 100% accurate to the letter representation, it's impossible. I mean, there's just no way to do that.
Going back to something we talked about at the very beginning, that like so much of what we write is about kind of meeting the expectation or like the knowledge base of what's in the cultural consciousness of the stories that we're telling. And so, you know, we're not creating a documentary piece. We're going in with kind of the shared knowledge that we all have and troubling that and getting under its skin and all of those things print emotional light on it.
Right.
Yeah. But I think it's great, especially when we talk about Carrie Strug, which it's the end. I didn't want to talk about it too much, but like what happens. And and it's one of those things that an example where I have seen distinct difference between how non-gymnastics people currently, like not in the context of this musical, but like in the context of news at the time and since, gymnastics people tend to really glorify me. Gymnastics people are horrified. And so to explore that complexly, I think is really important, especially for non-gymnastics audiences. Like a thing that I end up doing a lot is like people, every Olympic cycle, people will like share that story and be like, oh my God, it's the greatest thing ever. And then I comment and I'm like, it literally isn't. This is like a terrible choice.
I've really tried to, like dispel the idea that like was the only option and the only choice and that it was the correct choice. Obviously, like, Strug, I'm not speaking for Carrie Strug. I'm not Carrie Strug. I'm not in that position. And there are a lot of different pressures, as we know. But, like, as we continue, like, people made the comparisons with Simone. Like, well, Simone should have, you know, what? No, that's not really how, like, this works. You know, I think, and I always say, I go, the reason we have longevity in the sport or it's changing is because we've changed. And, you know, people are still competing on injuries. It's not that people aren't competing on injuries because they are. But, like, look at that situation and, like, the idea that Carrie Strug had to vault in order to win a gold medal, that's a false narrative. That's not true.
Yeah. And it's also, like, hard to. The complicated thing to explore as people who are like writing a story about it too, that like, do you want it to end on this like we've gotten here yay conclusion, and how much can you like better complicate that without leaving people like, and how do you want people to feel when they leave becomes a question, right? Like I'm glad that part answer so far to that has been like complicated.
I think really like to leave things off without any tidy answers because it just feels more true to life and more interesting. It doesn't sit well with all audiences, but
yes, I think it, you know, we are also like, you know, we're trying not to be didactic. We're trying not to force things, and so that moment, us imagining justifications that she had to make, some of the like acknowledgement of the sacrifices. One of the last lyrics in it is, it may cost my ankle, it may cost my childhood, it may cost a future I never will see. And you know, so it's so much, there's so much it wrapped up in that, both within our story and obviously in the actual event that that we keep exploring it as we go.
Yes, it's the finale of the show. So, I mean, there is a part that's like, it's big triumphant chords. And, you know, there is sort of this feeling, triumph that she does it, fully layered in with a good dose of, yeah, completion and troubling of that.
Mm-hmm. You can't change what happened. Like, right. That's the other thing, too. Like,
or that for her, it likely was in part a very momentous and
a lot of what we explore in the show is this like weird tension between being friends as teammates and also rivals and all of the like the weird stew of that, and that part of it is also she felt like she had to do it for her teammates in team goal, like there's so much in there. That's why it's a 7 or 8 minute song.
Yeah. I mean, so as we're wrapping up, you've talked a little bit about the fundraising that you're currently doing, which as comes out is still going on. So let's know like how to get there, what the deal is, all of that stuff. Can you talk a little bit more about the fundraising that you're currently doing?
So we have our fundraising campaign that. It basically, I mean, I don't know how much everyone people know about putting on shows, but as you'd expect, there's a lot of people putting in a lot of hours who you want to try to compensate fairly, or at least gesture towards compensating fairly. We've got this cast of 11 people. We've got a 4-person band. We've got a choreographer. We've got our great designers. So lots of people who we want to thank for their work. And we have a website. Basically, you can get to the campaign, the fundraising campaign. You can get to the ticket link for the show. You can get pieces of information. Gordon, I don't want to say it wrong. What's our website?
It is magnificent7musical.com.
And as this comes out, tickets will also be on sale for the show, which is running at Theater One at Theater Row July 7th to 17th.
Scheduled it long ago without realizing that our first performance of The Magnificent Seven was on 7/7.
7/7.
To 7/17. It, the universe, we felt like, is in our favor.
And cool. So we'll have links to everything in the description of this episode. We've already been retweeting y'all, but we'll keep doing that too.
Thank you.
And now Kina gets to go listen to all of it.
I am really excited. Like sometimes just in general, like I enjoy musical theater, but there have been times where people are like, this musical, like, and I'm the type of person too who like sometimes like the idea that I can't go see it off a little bit.
Yeah.
Just because like it took me, like, this is so embarrassing. Like it took me a long time to come around on Hamilton for that, like to actually sit down and listen to Hamilton, not because I'm not interested in musical theater or history. It was just like, okay. Or like I felt the same way about Six. I am obsessed with Six because I like studied early modern literature in graduate school. So like that whole concept, and it's like I'm ready to be obsessed with this thing.
Yes.
That's what I am ready for. It has happened. It is going to happen. I'm excited.
That is thrilling. And we do
have our Six connection because our director and choreographer are associates on the show.
I saw that.
It's been putting it up on cruise ships.
Ooh.
Which is fun. They left Tampa soon to come to join us in New York for putting this one up, which on land, I think is a much, despite all of the despite the how brief our rehearsal period is and all of that, at least we are on land.
I can't wait to just be like sitting in my classroom in the morning and being like, sorry, my dog. I can't wait to be sitting in my classroom in the morning and kids are going to be like, what are you listening to? And I'm going to be like, musical.
I know, as like the representatives like of the queer gymnastics people, like,
yes,
I mean, it really is on our shoulders. Like,
it is. Like,
nothing,
you know,
has ever been a more perfect intersection outside of the literal queer athletes that we have talked to.
Yes. But what do queer people love? Like, musical theater.
As like any queer person who was born in 1980 and 1986, like, that's another thing that we try to tap into with this is like, it's like the Sex and the City cast. Like, everyone had the gymnast that they identified with, but also something about how like arted they have to be and how button up and reserve, and like they're not able to, like, who you can tell is inside there.
Yeah.
And that's so, like, I think that's part of what drew me to it. Not just, you know, my older sister did high school gymnastics at the same time, but like, that I think is the thing that, and that's part of what, I guess, hero as the underdog, as the, you know, the overlooked one, all of that stuff is so baked in with
City. I like truly hate
they want it to be or not.
Yeah.
I truly hate the idea of being like, I was born in the wrong era, but I'm like, it truly does pain me that I was not old enough to comprehend. Like, my parents went to Atlanta. My parents saw some gymnastics competition. They did not see, like, you know, the team final, but they did like see gymnastics competition. They were down in Atlanta. They will talk about how crazy Atlanta was, actually. Their favorite story is when they watched a rowing team hail a cab because the public transportation. They're very like, this is why they're like, Chicago can't host the Olympics, because they're like, the public transportation can't handle the Olympics. But I truly wish that I had been born like 10 years earlier, in a sense, purely so I could have experienced Magnet 7 in real time instead of.
Yeah, we're 92 babies.
We're 92 babies. So like,
so we both went back, and this is now a part of like our gymnastics lexicon. But like, I was a gymnast in the 2000 and 2004 quads, mm-hmm. and so that's like where stuff started.
Right, and like, I remember like watching parts of those things, but like, I, you know, it's like that distinct of like the first. I did rec gym as a kid, like the first Olympics where I could truly comprehend in a like sense what was going on is like 2008.
Is there anything else that we didn't get to that you want to make sure that people know before we go?
So
yeah, this was perfect.
This was great. Yeah.
Lovely.
Yes.
Also, we have all the social media stuff too. So we have Mag 7 musical. This is the one instance in which 7 is a number as opposed to written out, but Mag 7 musical on Twitter and magnificent.7.musical on Facebook and Instagram. Right now we're in the process of rolling out, introducing our cast members, but once we get into rehearsals, we'll have some maybe some little videos and things to check out on various socials.
We will link that all below.
Wonderful.
Thank you all so much for being here. We're so excited for the musical. We hope that everybody gets to go and see it.
Yes, I'm so excited.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for being here. It was
hopefully we'll see you in July.
We've been talking.
We've discussed.
All right, perfect. Thank you so much.